Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let's have another week. With approval by the U.S. State Department, the plan to build a new second bridge from Detroit to Windsor is moving forward. On today's show, we take a look at the community in Detroit where the bridge will be built, just what will happen to the Delray neighborhood. Then we'll speak with a woman who has hiked the shorelines of all five Great Lakes. But first, to the state capitol, where we saw a flurry of voting last week as lawmakers put together the next state budget, expected to total about $48 billion. The Republican-controlled State House approved spending for schools and colleges, as well as a budget to fund the rest of state government. The state Senate, of course, also controlled by the GOP, approved about half of its budget plan, with more votes scheduled this week. And now this sets the stage for negotiations between the two chambers all through May, because the goal in Lansing is to get that budget completed by June 1st. Joining us now are Chad Livengood, Lansing reporter for the Detroit News. Welcome back, Chad.
Thanks for having me.
And Chris Gouts, who is Capitol correspondent for Crane's Detroit Business. Hi, Chris.
Hello, how are you?
Good to have you both back. I want to start with an issue that we have talked about so many times here on Stateside, and that would be transportation funding. Governor Snyder wants more than $1 billion annually, more in funding for roads and bridges, but it isn't looking like he's getting what he is looking for, or is he? Can you fill us in, Chad?
Right now, the budgets that have passed out of these both chambers do not include the whole $1.2 billion more in new funding. The House basically found some money to fill the state's commitment to get a full federal match because there's been a reoccurring shortfall in the amount of money that our gas tax is producing every year to get the federal matching funds. And the Senate has included roughly over about $130 million more out of Treasury that they think that is available there. But all sides are coming up short here because there is not an agreement on how to raise the $1.2 billion to get to that point. And the governor had proposed a series of fairly significant hikes in vehicle registration fees, which is effectively known as the birthday tax, because you pay it on your birthday.
Right.
And also a gas tax increase from 19 cents to 33 cents on regular gasoline per gallon. Those did not go over too well. So they're back to the drawing board here, and they've been debating a lot of different alternatives.
So therein lies the rub. Chris, give us a sense of some of those alternatives to the birthday tax and the gas tax.
Well, I've heard actually talk of going back to something that we've talked about in the program before that has been sort of called hippie punching, where you tax those who have alternative vehicles because they're sort of the biggest culprits of not paying gas, buying gas at the pump and contributing to the roads. I don't know that that's going to fly, but that's sort of the one of these things that's been out there. But I think sort of the latest evolution of all this is that the alternative might be that they'll just go ahead and do some sort of straight tax increase, because the conventional thinking all along was that Republicans were going to have Democratic votes. And there was a very reportedly contentious meeting between the legislative quadrant late last week where they apparently devolved into a sort of a shouting match. And the House Speaker walked away from that meeting sending feelers out there through the media that they're just going to try to go it alone now, that they feel that the Democrats are just not going to budge, and so that they're just going to do this on their own, sort of the way in which the Blue Cross bills were approved late last year when the Democrats wouldn't help because they were so angry over right to work. They said the Republicans just went to the right, and they included that abortion language that got enough votes to get it done. The Speaker is now saying openly that's what they're considering doing with transportation. So if the Democrats aren't going to help, they're just going to find other ways to pacify their members so that when they go back to their districts, they can say, yes, I voted for this tax increase, but look, I also voted for maybe prevailing wage or a new set of abortion bills. They're going to give them other things to package this with to sort of make the tax increase vote sort of less than the anger amongst the constituents.
Contentious meeting? Never, Lansing. All right, let's switch over to another issue that Republicans in the legislature and Governor Snyder can't seem to quite get on the same page about, expanding Medicaid funding. Chad, can you give us the background? What's going on here?
Well, the governor had called for increasing the income eligibility rate for enrolling in Medicaid, which is the state-federal partnership health insurance for the poor, to 133% of the poverty level of income, which is roughly a little under $15,000 for a single individual or $30,000 for a family of four. This is what is called for under the Affordable Care Act. as part of the, you know, the nationwide effort to get nearly every American on health insurance. The governor came out strongly for this with backing from lots of different players in the business community. The whole hospital medical community was obviously in favor of it because they absorb tens of millions of dollars every year in uncompensated care. And it has just hit a roadblock in the legislature where you have a Republican-controlled House and Senate that is very much opposed to many of the tenets of Obamacare, because this is one of them.
Yeah.
And so they have not included it in either budget. And by all accounts, we're more likely to see our taxes go up on gasoline than we are to see the Medicaid expansion approved here before the 4th of July, I would think.
Huh. Chris, I want to have you fill us in on an issue that we have been keeping an eye on here at Stateside, and that's the film tax credits. And the House stripped away $25 million in tax credits, but even Governor Snyder, who's not a big fan of them, and the GOP in the state Senate want to keep at least that money. What's going on here?
Well, I think in the end, I think you're still going to see movies produced here in the coming years. This happened last year, and I believe even the year before, if I'm not mistaken. The House always cuts this money that they don't like the program, and it plays well back home because people don't like that we're giving all this money to Hollywood, you know, stars, even though that's really not the case anymore. And so they cut the $25 million that the governor had proposed, and it was $50 million this year, I believe. And they put that money towards transportation. They said, you know, budgets are about priorities, and our priority and the governor's priority seems to be transportation. So put your money where your mouth is, and let's not give this money, give these handouts to Hollywood, and let's, you know, fix the roads. And obviously, it's a very small amount. It was a part of a $300 million that the House could cobble together for transportation. So they took it out. It's going to come back in the Senate for sure. Senate Majority Leader Randy Richfield is probably the biggest proponent of the industry in the entire legislature. And the governor, like you said, is on board. So it got taken out in the House, but I'm sure in the final product, you'll see that money back in.
We're talking with Chad Livengood, who's the Lansing reporter for the Detroit News, and Chris Gouts, Capital Correspondent for Crain's Detroit Business, kind of picking apart what's been happening in Lansing as lawmakers put together the next state budget. And Chris Gouts, what are we missing? What have we not discussed yet that you're going to be keeping your eye on?
I mean, those are really the big things. I think the other thing, obviously, is school funding, and that gets changed every day. It's really not even worth trying to keep track anymore of what they're saying that the per pupil allocation is going to be. You know, the Republicans say that it's a 2% increase for schools, and that they're counting certain things, and the Democrats aren't counting certain things, so that they can go back and say that, you know, we're actually cutting schools after getting, you know, schools got whacked way before. There's still this fight over whether or not we should be even using school aid fund into the community college and higher education budgets. And then the other thing that we saw last week that came out in terms of higher education and all other areas of the budget is that the House Republicans removed the right to work punitive language out of all those budgets so that they'll no longer be penalized for having signed contracts with their unions, which they were free and legal to do prior to the March 28th enactment of right to work.
I'm wondering, from the perspective of both of you, as you're sitting there, you're watching this, you did mention contentious meetings over transportation funding. Is there anything where people could say, gee, Democrats and Republicans are kind of standing together on one of these issues? Are there any points of agreement?
There's not a lot of agreement. I mean, one example on this road funding, where this sort of went off the tracks last week, the House Minority Leader, Representative Tim Grimmel of Auburn Hills, Democrat, he basically played the terrorism card and accused a Republican Speaker, Jay Spolger, of terroristic-type tactics in the negotiations over this. And he used the word terrorism. And he said, quote, we're not going to negotiate with terrorists. So, and then obviously that got a lot of condemnation and just kind of became a little bit of a sideshow up here. But that's not a lot of a room for agreement. You've got a big midterm election coming up, and the governor's up for re-election, and the entire state senate's up for re-election, and the whole House is at stake. So the Democrats aren't necessarily going to go along with a lot of things that the majority party wants to do, and they're especially not going to make vulnerable Democrats in middle ground, battleground-type seats vote for things that they could, especially like a tax increase on gas, that could be just turned around and used against them in the election next year.
Chris Gutz, do you see them achieving their goal to get the budget done by June 1st?
You know, I think so. I mean, they've done it for 2 years in a row, and I don't see why they can't do it for a third. I mean, it's obviously very easy to get a budget done when you have the House and the Senate and the governor's seat controlled by the same party, which, you know, obviously wasn't the case when Granholm was in office. And so we saw how hard, difficult that was to do and even getting the government shut down. So, yeah, I think they'll do it when you just have to, all you have to do is argue about, you know, how conservative you want a budget to be. It's not about, you know, having to actually negotiate, you know, real, you know, heavy things. Not that they're not doing that now, but they're all on the same page in some respects. I will say that there is this one area in Medicaid where you do actually have both sides in agreement. You have at least members of both sides in agreement, where you have Matt Lurie, who chairs the community health budget in the House, is a Republican, who actually agrees with the governor that it should be in there. Even though he controls the committee, he didn't put it in his budget because he knew that the rest of the majority of his caucus doesn't support it. So it's really going to be a matter of educating members. You know, a lot of them just don't understand how Medicaid works, and some of them might be worried about being primaried because their opponent will say that they voted for this budget and therefore they support Obamacare, and that's a death knell in a Republican primary. So for those that actually understand how it works and understand the benefits of it, we'll see if, you know, facts and reasoning will win out, win the day here.
That was Chris Gouts, Capital Correspondent for Crain's Detroit Business, and he was joined by Chad Livengood, who's the Lansing reporter for the Detroit News. As always, we enjoy talking with you guys. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having us.
As we move into our middle years, many of us yearn to do something to change things up in a big way. But what? Well, Battle Creek's Laureen Neuenheis took that question and challenge and really came up with something different. She got up from her desk, she put on her hiking boots, and she started walking and walking and walking. First, Laureen walked 1,019 miles around Lake Michigan. Then she decided to hit the shorelines of all five Great Lakes. That was the big challenge for last year. Her adventures are chronicled in her new book, A 1,000-Mile Great Lakes Walk, One Woman's Trek Along the Shorelines of All Five Great Lakes, published by Crick Hollow Books. And Laureen Neuenheis has taken off her hiking boots. She is wearing much more fashionable boots, and she joins us in the studio. Welcome, Laureen.
Thank you.
Well, the obvious question, as I read your book, you were hiking in pouring rain, you were hiking in winds, blazing sunshine. You walked lakesides, you walked your way through cities, you walked around nuclear power plants, you dealt with hordes of deer flies, and you just kept walking. Why so?
I wanted to get to know my favorite place step by step and record it in my muscles and my bones, and my favorite place is Lake Michigan. And that adventure was so much fun, I thought, that can't be the only one. So that's why I did another 1,000-mile hike last year.
Wow, and I'd like you, if you would, to share a passage that you wrote about what it was like when you were out in the woods and you were worrying a little about some furry critters.
Oh, yeah.
I've highlighted that. I'd love to hear your own voice and share that with us.
Sure. The sun was beginning to go down and the woods got thicker as I hiked. It started to look like really good bear country. I heard coyote yipping in the woods and a murder of ravens squawking like they owned the place. I started singing out loud to alert any large carnivores lurking about to my presence. One was my impression of Ethel Merman singing, "There's no business like show business." I even added some jazz hands along the way. I was pretty sure no self-respecting bear would be able to eat me after that. Another song I often sang was a two-part opera I made up. In the lowest voice I could manage, I'd sing, "Don't eat me, I don't taste good. You think that I would, but I don't." That would be followed by my highest voice singing, "Actually, I'm delicious, but I won't tell that to you." I'd switch back and forth between the parts, arguing with myself in two voices. Somehow I figured this would not only entertain and alert the top of the food chain, but would also make them think that there was possibly more than one of me. I'm not sure how convinced they were, but hey, I emerged without getting any invitations to be dinner.
And here you are sitting with us now. Just delightful. Laureen, did you view your walk? So, you know, over the course of the 70 or so days, you did over 1,000 miles. So you were on each of the shores of our five Great Lakes. What do you feel this was an act of environmental activism, or what did you see this as?
Activism and education. I think the more people understand the lakes, the more they understand that this water is moving to the sea, but it's doing it very slowly, that water in Lake Superior can be there for hundreds of years before it enters Lake Huron. We can get past the old adage that dilution is the solution to pollution, because it's not. If this water is going to be here for hundreds of years, we don't want to be tossing pollution and industrial waste into the lakes. So definitely an act of education to understand these lakes and to understand how they differ from each other and how they work together as a system.
One gets a sense reading your book and also going on to your blog, where you have lots of videos and photographs. Each lake has a real personality, doesn't it?
Distinct. They do.
Distinct.
Yeah. Yeah.
So give us an idea of what you found from more intimate experience than most of us would have of the varying personalities of our Great Lakes.
Well, Lake Erie is the youngest of the group geologically, and it's kind of a teenager. It will throw a tantrum every once in a while. When a storm blows across, Lake Erie can throw the biggest fit, and you don't expect that because it's the smallest Great Lake and the shallowest, but it can be quite dangerous. Lake Huron has these beautiful, vast limestone deposits. The largest open-pit limestone mine in the world is up near Rogers City.
I think most of us didn't know that. I didn't.
I didn't know that either. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I got a tour of the mine. I love mine tours.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Lake Huron has this undergirding of the limestone. And that's one of the reasons that the zebra mussels and the quagga mussels have done so well there, because there's all this dissolved calcium in the water.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Lake Michigan is my old friend. We have the Sunset Coast in Michigan and just the beautiful sandy beaches. Yeah. And I expected all of Lake Michigan to be sandy beaches, and it's not.
You discovered it wasn't.
No, and exploring the geology and having that picture come into focus for me was a fascinating part of this adventure.
Mm-hmm.
Lake Superior is the wildest, the coldest, the deepest, just geologically very significant. There are things up there that there are whole books written about the geology of the Keweenaw alone.
Yeah.
So I just loved exploring the wild side up there.
and you actually had a chance to do some of this with your son.
I
so
did.
So that special mom-son thing must have been made that a real special part. You were up in the Keweenaw with him?
Yes, and Pictured Rocks. We hiked the entire length of Pictured Rocks together. Yeah.
We're speaking with author Laureen Neuenheis. Her book is all about her 1,000-mile hike over the shorelines of all five of our Great Lakes. And Laureen, over the time you were walking, what did you learn about Michigan and about its people?
I think Michiganders understand that we have a much larger stake in the health of these lakes than any other state. Mm-hmm. There are 8 states and the province of Ontario that touch the Great Lakes. Michigan touches 4 of the 5 Great Lakes, and we are peninsular people. Our state has these watery edges. So I think the connection to these waters is greater with the people of Michigan. When I hiked through Wisconsin on my first hike, I was surprised that Wisconsinites, I believe they're called, mm-hmm. they go inland for recreation because the lakeshore is not as accessible. There are clay cliffs along the way. There are very few stretches where it's a sandy beach. So geology influences how people interact with their lakes.
And so we in Michigan have just the opportunity to be able to interact in every way possible.
Definitely.
I guess I kind of wondered your thoughts as someone, as you walked and you had a chance to think and look, what do you feel now based on this are the main threats that the Great Lakes face? What worries you for the Great Lakes?
The biggest threat and the thing I find just historically in the last couple decades, the thing that can throw these ecosystems completely out of whack mm-hmm. are invasive species. And I find it hard to believe we don't have strict ballast water control measures, or just say ocean-going vessels, stay in the ocean, transfer your cargo to the lake freighters.
Mm.
I don't know why there isn't a very simple, there is a very simple and elegant solution to this.
That would take care of that, yes.
It would.
And we've heard that so often from the water experts when we talk with them on stateside, that ballast issue.
And restoration of wetlands is another huge thing that will improve the health of the lakes. And the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, which was a 5-year funding mm-hmm. program, has done measurable things to improve the health of our lakes. So I'm very encouraged by that.
Back to one woman walking that 1,000 miles, starting out around Port Clinton, all of this, ending at Niagara Falls. I know very well where you were. You're on that Ontario side. So you had a chance to taste Ontario and you were in Toronto.
Yeah.
But I guess I have to just give it up to you for the sheer determination and your good cheer. As I went on your blog, which, by the way, is laketrek.blogspot.com, I love the video. It really touched me that you shot of yourself as you were struggling along a highway in the thumb. You were battling high winds, and you had a couple more miles to go.
Yeah.
And you said, I like to sing to myself. And what song did you sing to get yourself that last 2 miles?
What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Stronger.
Good old Kelly Clarkson was there with you.
She was there kicking my butt. Yeah.
So how has this, for you personally, how has this, these two huge hikes that you've done, these two big adventures, how has it made you stronger?
Oh, it's completely redefined the limits that I thought I had in my life. All those walls that were kind of closing in are completely pushed back. And it's, I was pretty empowered before this, but now I almost feel like I can take flight at times, which is lovely. I feel like I can take on any project.
So what's next? I know you've got two big journeys. What do you want to do next?
I'm doing another 1,000-mile adventure. This time it will be kayaking and hiking, exploring the islands of the Great Lakes. There are islands in every single Great Lake, and I'm actually starting it this summer, woven in with my book tour.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll take part in some scientific research on some of the islands. I'm going to work with the rangers keeping track of the piping plovers on South Manitou this summer. So I'm just thrilled about this new adventure and just a different component. And I think this series will be a trilogy. I can see the box set. So,
and then the made-for-TV movie or some kind of thing following that. The book is a 1,000-mile Great Lakes walk, one woman's trek along the shorelines of all five Great Lakes, Lorene Nieuwenhuis. And Lorene will actually be appearing tonight at Literati Bookstore at 124 East Washington in Ann Arbor and at 7 p.m. Yep. But the book is available.
It's actually only available at select independent bookstores right now. Independent bookstores really championed my first book, hand sold it. It was picked up all over. And as a thank you to them, I'm giving them a 2-month jump on sales before it goes into full distribution in June.
And again, her website is laketrek.blogspot.com. Lots of fun videos and songs, just like she treated us to. Lorene Nieuwenhuis, it's really a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much. And you're going to keep us posted on the progress of your whole adventure with the islands.
Definitely. Thanks for having me.
This is National Autism Awareness Month. More than 50,000 people here in Michigan have been diagnosed with some form of autism. 16,000 of those people are children. In Southwest Michigan, there's a growing effort to create a special place for adults with autism to live and work, a farm. Two mothers of autistic sons are leading the movement to acquire enough land to build what they call ACORN, Autism Agricultural Community Option for Residential Needs. It's not the first such program in Michigan, but it would be the very first of its kind for adults with autism in Southwest Michigan. One of those moms is Kathy Pinto. She's a retired public safety officer and mother of four, including her 22-year-old autistic son, Tom. Kathy, thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So tell me, first of all, a little about your son, Tom.
My son, Tom, is 21. He started probably when he was 9 or 10 riding horses at Chef Center, which is also in Kalamazoo County. They do therapeutic horseback riding. And there he learned a love of horses. And somewhere between there and his teenage years, he decided he loved all things farm. He enjoyed horses, cows, chickens, pigs. It was all fascinating to him. So that is what led me to answering an ad in a local autism newsletter where Cindy Seamark, my co-founder, put just a little blurb in there that said, is anyone interested in possible farm community for adults with autism?
Hmm.
I had never considered that. So I called her up and we went from there.
And your vision of ACORN is what? If it could be fully realized, what would ACORN be?
Oh, it'll be a wonderful place. It will have homes where people with autism can live. We would like to see people without autism living out on the farm We would like to have vocational opportunities involving both the farm animals, other agricultural pursuits. We would love to see the local colleges, K College, Western Michigan University, Kalamazoo Valley Community College, have a presence with us out on the farm. We want it to be a vibrant community where people in our community come out to Acorn, and the residents of Acorn are still a part of the Kalamazoo community.
And what would the benefit be to Southwest Michigan, to the community, of having Acorn Farm up and running?
Having more options and opportunities for people with autism, in particular when you consider the rise in the diagnosis, and the thought that if the number of people being diagnosed and coming through the educational system starts showing up in the adult system in the next 10 or 15 years, it's going to absolutely overwhelm what we currently have. Hmm. So we're trying with Acorn Farm to get ahead of that wave a little bit and have an option that I know my son Tom will love, and I'm certain there will be other young adults attracted to Acorn Farm. And should it be their choice where they'd like to live, then that should be an option for them.
So what type of timetable? When, if you could wave your magic wand, I know you'd like to have it here and now, today, ready, up and running. What's your hope? What's your best guess when you might be able to actually open the gate to Acorn Farm?
Well, I would love to see it within 2 to 5 years. I know that's kind of a broad assessment.
And for Tom and the thousands of other autistic adults and children in Michigan, your hopes are?
My hopes are that every adult with autism, every adult with a disability is offered the opportunity to have as many options available so that they can choose what life looks like for them, whether it's in the city or the country, whether it's working with horses or in an office. Whatever makes them happy is what they should have. And that's why I'm working towards this farm option, because it's the option that's most meaningful to my son.
The website is acornfarm.org, and remember, that is with two A's, AACORNfarm.org. And I've been talking with the president of Acorn Farm, Kathy Pinto. Kathy, thanks so much. Good luck.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The new International Trade Crossing Bridge has taken a big step closer to becoming reality. That's after the U.S. State Department approved the project to create a second span across the Detroit River from Detroit to Windsor. Now, there's a group watching the progress of this project very, very closely. That would be the neighbors, business owners, and civic leaders in the Delray District. That's where the bridge would be planted. That's where traffic would flow, trucks would rumble, and life will change. The question is, will the bridge mean good things to the Southwest Detroit neighborhood and its residents, or will their quality of life be sacrificed for the economic benefits to Michigan? Or can the two coexist, a win-win for Delray and the state of Michigan? Joining me in the studio is Simone Sugovac. She's with the Southwest Detroit Community Benefits Coalition. Thank you so much for being here, Simone.
Thank you.
For people listening to us who are not familiar with Delray, give us a sense of what the neighborhood is like, the history, and who's there now.
Delray, for many years, was sort of an immigration point historically. It was a Hungarian community and a long time ago, and always very mixed ethnically. And so over the years, it was a place where people came, moved there because they worked there. And over time, as industry changed, as the economy changed, there's been a lot of decline. And however, it's a place that has deep roots. A lot of the families stem back generations who live there. Delray is a community along the riverfront. We're situated in southwest Detroit, which already hosts our current border crossing and numerous heavy industries, all which have an accumulated impact on quality of life and health in the community, unlike other places in Michigan and really even in the country. It has that significant of impacts.
Because of being right there on the river and so close to industry, people in Delray are used to living with really a lot of demands in terms of industry. And as you say, there already is the Ambassador Bridge. So it's not something alien to people in Delray as far as coping with demands.
True. And the kind of industry has changed, too, over time, from things like soap factory, and we also host currently and have for many years the state's Southeast Michigan Detroit Water and Sewage Plant, the wastewater treatment plant, which serves a third of Michigan's population. So it's a pretty vast operation, and all of the impacts of these industries, people don't think about it, but the fact that we've got coal-fired power plants here, steel mills here. Not too far away, we have the Marathon Oil Refinery and the state's largest rail yard. And all of these things together do have these combined effects. And, that leads to things like one of the highest asthma rates in the state. We have 1 in 5 children in Southwest Detroit who have asthma. We have, in the zip code that includes the current border crossing, we have adults who have asthma hospitalization rates that are 3 times the rate for the state. And so we saw a spike, for example, when the Gateway project was underway that realigned the highways to the current bridge. We saw, as trucks were rerouted and on our surface streets, many people, adults in their 30s and 40s, were getting asthma for the first time. And so even though that's considered to be often a childhood disease, something where maybe there's lung function issues when children are born, you can see that it's a lung function issue throughout life where maybe our health is compromised from the kind of environmental impacts that we have, like the diesel pollution from the trucks at our border.
So is it safe to say air quality is one of the major concerns of as you look at the prospect of a second bridge?
Absolutely it is. There was an environmental study done on the project as required. A final environmental impact study was done. And the conclusion in that project was that air quality will improve. And that statement was made for what will happen in the broader region. The argument is you have 2 bridges, traffic flows better, less congestion, less pollution. However, it's absolutely not true in the immediate community where a 160-acre customs plaza is going to be built. And by the report's own predictions, truck traffic will increase 128%. So our current level of 8,000 trucks per day, 10,000 at the high before the economic recession.
Mm-hmm.
If it doubles, more than doubles, we're looking at more than 20,000 trucks per day coming through a small community, and people whose homes are directly across the street from the footprint of this project will not be bought out, just as an example. So that large impact.
Homes will not be bought out.
The homes in the footprint of where mm-hmm. the actual infrastructure will be built will be purchased.
Yes.
And that will be according to the HUD regulations and guidelines for the Relocation Act. And however, they're not allowed to go outside of that footprint, which gets to the point of our coalition. And one of the strategies has been to pursue something called a community benefits agreement, which expands upon the guarantees, the minimal guarantees that will be provided through this the federal process.
And how are you trying to affect that? When you talk about these community benefits, from whom? Canada and United States, state of Michigan? Who are you appealing to?
The community has always said, from the decision makers on the project, from those other entities who will benefit from the project. And so that's pretty broad.
Mm-hmm.
But as we have been on this journey for more than 5 years, the community has been on it for nearly 10 years when the discussions of a second bridge first came up and the studies and the community engagement with
yes.
MDOT. But for the past 5 years, the coalition has been working to influence those who are making decisions by educating about what the true impacts are going to be. And also, when the project first came up, communities up and down river, there were several possible locations for the project. And all of them were looked into to various degrees. And communities up and down river came out and said, no, we don't want a bridge. And the community of Del Rey said the same thing. And the issue is that the bridge has to be built along the narrowest part of the river.
Okay.
And at least cost-wise, it was going to end up in the narrowest part of the river. And so over time, it became apparent, and with this struggling community, that maybe there could be a win-win situation here. If the bridge were built in a way where the development could benefit the community as well as the industry who will benefit and the economies of both Michigan, the United States, and Canada, $40 billion in trade passes over that bridge, which benefits both economies. The bridge investment on the U.S. side is approximately $2 billion.
Uh-huh.
And with all that, with the major users of the bridge being the auto companies, there's a lot of recognition that this is an economic necessity and a huge benefit to the economies. And so we're saying it could be a benefit to the people who are going to sacrifice the most from the project.
If
there are the guarantees for community benefits. And so this, our approach has been to, as I said, educate. We found ourselves having to approach the legislature when it was being discussed by the Michigan legislature, and there were bills introduced for the bridge. And we were successful to get a bill passed through the House of Representatives. It didn't pass through the Senate. When I say we, it was the broader community just engaged in the process and really trying to tour people around the area, have people see who are going to be making decisions on this bridge, where the project will actually be. Because we have always felt that the bridge should be built as if it were in anybody's community. Anyone, if you're a decision maker on the project, should think, what if you were building this bridge in your community?
Yes, what would you want?
Exactly.
Have you been able to get Governor Snyder's ear? Have you been able to
meet
with him? All right. Well, how did that go?
So the governor came. He spoke to the community. He toured around the community. He said, in fact, that the bridge should be the place around the bridge should be a beautiful place, just like if you were looking at the Mackinac Island Bridge and it was an eye shot. And we couldn't agree more. He talked about the children in the community and talked about the need for jobs. What happened last June 15th was the signing of the U.S.-Canada agreement between both countries. And in that agreement, there's opening language that says that there will be community benefits as part of the request for proposals or the bidding process. So the developers who will be vying to build this bridge will have to address community benefits. Where we still need to make progress is the specifics are not there.
So you're hearing, you're getting, it sounds like an open-minded, if not even sympathetic reception, as you outlined from the governor, but you want to see it on paper.
There needs to be guarantees, yes.
So what would that look like? What do you want to see?
The community has, from the beginning, wanted to be sure that there weren't going to be increased air quality impacts in the community, but there were actual programs, investments made to address diesel pollution. This has been done in different ways in different places. We point to a very successful program at the Los Angeles Long Beach ports, where they developed with a private port owner. They developed a program to reduce diesel emissions through filters on trucks. And so they were successful. After just a couple of years, they set out to do it in five. They completed it in under 3 years, and they've reduced diesel emissions 80%.
So that would be something mandated the trucks would have to have, although the Long Beach is not international.
Exactly.
So you've got the international component.
Exactly. So we know that there are differences, but there are also tremendous opportunities. And these things, when we clean up the environment, we also improve the economy. We improve daily quality of life. We improve household incomes because parents don't have to take time off work because either they or their children have asthma. It's a number one reason for missed school days and the number one reason for lost work time in our community.
What's being done by your counterparts on the Ontario side? Are you working in unison? Where are they compared to where you're at?
Well, the Canadians are much further ahead in implementing the project on the Canadian side. And also, they had a very different process where, in the beginning, the community on that side in Windsor also said no to the initial proposals. And they were successful in moving the highway further away from the concentration of residents, which, in their minds, was actually helping to improve quality of life and health through less exposure to diesel emissions. And so they also have plans to tunnel part of the expressway, the connection, because the one reason why industry really likes this project is that it's going to provide a direct connection highway to highway from the U.S. to the Canadian side and eliminate all the traffic lights that have been a source of congestion and delays.
Anyone who's gone on Highway 2B knows that very, very well. Yes,
exactly.
Coming from Canada to the U.S.
So they've planned various green infrastructure and tunneling of the freeway on their side. And we'd like to see those kinds of things. We're a community on the river with no connection to the riverfront in southwest Detroit. And southwest Detroit itself is one of the most growing communities within Detroit, has been a lot due to the immigration that we've had and the success of the immigrant businesses in our community. And we really want to see a connection to, for example, Fort Wayne, beautiful historic Fort Wayne. Mm-hmm. And we believe it's possible. And we would love to see it done on our side the way it's being done on the Canadian side.
Is there a fear that's been expressed by people in Delray because it's so heavily immigrant that they will be, their concerns will be somehow overlooked or diminished?
I would say all along that's not only been the fear, but it's been the reality. There have been policies, we call it unwritten policies in place to actually provide less services to the community. There was a time when it was more connected directly to downtown, and that connection provided access to various services. Now Delray is more like an island and due to be even further cut off because four interchanges or four places that you can overpasses that you can cross over the freeway are going to be cut off in this project. So there's almost nothing. People can't get to a store. 40% don't drive in Delray. It's a very poor community. And when you're poor, you don't have as much voice. And so that is most definitely a concern. And in fact, when you look at the 160-acre footprint of this project and you look at the price of land, 70% of the land is available, vacant land that the city owns. You couldn't put that footprint up or downriver in another community at the price tag that they're going to build this bridge. And we say, don't do it on the backs of the poor community. Make it be a win-win project. And it can be.
Simone Segovac, what would it look like if indeed you get the community benefits language on paper, it becomes part of the agreement, the bridge is built, so roll ahead a few years and it is a win-win situation in your hopes for Delray. What would that area look like? What would Delray look like?
The community would have more access to services. We would have a home improvement project so that those who've been suffering from decades of the industrial exposure and now more exposure will have the improvements to their quality of life, green space, some buffering between where the bridge and the industry is, some connections from the recreation center where children, the only recreation center we have, connections from the recreation center to the riverfront. And we would have access to jobs for the residents in the community. We're very serious about providing information and training opportunities for people so that those, again, who will be most impacted by the project could have the opportunity for economic improvement for their families.
As the project begins to get momentum, certainly the presidential approval was very important. Would you say that the mood in Delray is predominantly one of anticipation or dread or both?
I think that we've recognized all along that people have very different feelings about this project. They always have. And we're asking a lot of people. And so when I say that we, I mean the decision makers actually on the project are asking a lot of the people in the community and what they will have to give up. And you can't look at it with a judgmental eye as, well, you know, they should be glad to get, you know, to leave the area because home is home. And for people in the community, it's not just the dwelling that they live in. It's the relationships of their aunt across the street or their good friend next door who have supported the social fabric, the social network of this community, and especially the elderly residents. And there are many of them in the community. And so there have always been people who did not want the project and then people who said, yeah, this is an opportunity. Maybe I can better myself and leave the area and do better for my children. So I would say now with the decision, the one thing is that we've wanted an end to the delays because the delays themselves in a bridge decision have brought further harm upon the community. So there's some sense of relief in knowing something, and now there's still the anticipation and concern for it to be done right.
So the idea of stalemate, nobody's moving ahead when there's stalemate.
Exactly.
Simone Segovac is with the Southwest Detroit Community Benefits Coalition. I am certain that as this story unfolds and we move toward that second bridge, that we will be talking again, I have no doubt. Simone, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you so much for letting us be on.
And we would like to hear from you. What do you think of today's interviews? Who would you like us to profile? Stories we should tell? You can find us online at michiganradio.org. You can go to Facebook, and all you have to do is search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. So reach out. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered today by Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Austin Davis, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.